How's it going, everybody, and welcome to episode number 55 of Master My Garden podcast. Now, this week's episode is a really exciting one for me, and I'm delighted to be joined by Charles Dowding, a no-dig gardening expert. Now, this episode was requested by a listener who wants to know more about no-dig gardening, and it's a question that I've been asked on several occasions. And if I'm honest, I'm aware of the principles, but I've never practiced it, and I don't know that much about it. So when you think about no-dig gardening, Charles is probably the go-to expert in it. He's been practicing this system for a long time, and he'll tell us all about it in a few minutes, but he has done this practice in, I think, about four different gardens or market garden situations, different soil types, and it has proven successful. And I know from following him on YouTube and so on that all around the world, his methods are being practiced and being practiced successfully. So it seems like a superb idea. I mentioned it last week's episode where I had a listener question again, where we had a busy couple who were looking to get started with vegetables. And I reckoned because they were a busy working family that they wanted as little work as possible, but as much return as possible, and recommended the no-dig system to them. So Charles is going to tell us all about it, and we're going to talk about his books and lots of other things as well. But I suppose to get started, Charles, you're very, very welcome to Master My Garden podcast.
Thank you for that, John. It's very nice to be here and to have the chance to have a chat to your listeners all about no-dig and growing vegetables more easily.
It's a really easy, and I suppose just on that question, I had a question last week from, it was a couple. And I know the lady of the couple was working in a very busy job, and they were looking to start growing vegetables. And I assume, even though I didn't get much detail in it, but I would assume that the fact that they're not going to have much time, so that would make this system, I suppose, ideal for them. And maybe by way of it, of getting started on it, you might just give us an introduction to no-dig and, you know, that sort of the principles of it, maybe.
Okay, yeah, but that's exactly the kind of person. But I mean, it's for anybody really, because who does want to spend time doing unnecessary jobs? And for me, you know, I've been doing this 40 years now. I can see it pretty clearly, I would say. There is so much unnecessary work recommended in gardening, and it puzzles me a bit where it comes from. I think it's a human tendency to repeat things that they've heard from somebody else and assume it's necessary when it's actually good to question things more than we do. And one of the great things about lockdown, actually, is that it's got people at home, and, you know, twiddling their thumbs a bit and looking around them and thinking, oh, what can I do now? and getting into gardening. And I find it's the beginners, actually, who cotton on to no-dig more easily than experienced gardeners, because they haven't been taught, they haven't absorbed too much of the information that, you know, a lot of it comes from Victorians in the UK, sort of, you know, you must do this and you must do that. It's all that rule that you get at school and that kind of thing. And it's so simple. You know, no-dig actually is so simple. I think that's one reason why some people struggle to take it seriously, especially some professional gardeners, because all you need to do is leave soil undisturbed, allow soil life, which is already there and busy working as a site, to get on with its work. But what works really well is that you feed it. So it's about feeding soil life. And it's thinking in a different way as well with no-dig. So, you know, we've been conditioned and taught to think in terms of feeding plants with nutrients. And, you know, a lot of this comes from commercial pressure, I have to say. You know, buy fertilizers, you know, feed your plants, that kind of thing. And it's actually much more relaxed than that. Feed the soil in an ongoing and natural, easy way, where you put compost. I recommend compost as, for vegetables, the key element. It doesn't have to be compost if you're growing, say, fruit trees. You could mulch, your surface organic mulch can be undecomposed materials like hay, straw, grass, whatever, bracken, seaweed. You know, there's no end to possibilities. But for vegetables, which are the more difficult, really, of in horticulture, the more difficult plants to grow and demanding and slug sensitive, all those kinds of things, that's where the compost really comes in, because it's ready-made soil food which doesn't harbour slugs and snails and just goes straight into the worm's mouth or centipede, millipede, whatever it might be, and So you kind of shortcut nature's natural process of decomposing matter with lots of other things in the process. So you make your compost in the heat, put it on, and it's ready-made soil food, and then quite quickly you can get a wonderful harvest with probably the biggest bonus of all is few weeds. You know, that undisturbed soil, which has not been messed around. Obviously, there's some weed seeds always around and some weed seeds in compost and so on. I'm not saying it's a no-weed process. There'll be some perennial weeds grow through, and that's where the starting out process using some cardboard is useful, but not vital ongoing. You know, cardboard is only year one. Forget it after that. You don't need it anymore. You've cleaned your soil of couch grass and whatever it might be. And then, you know, you're in a really joyful place because you can spend your time being creative and sowing, planting, and then harvesting in this natural way, and you've got time to reflect a bit. You know, I love some of the comments I get, like, you know, guys saying, I went down the allotments, I was going to weed my onions out. Let me down, I couldn't find many weeds. Well, you know, had a flask of tea and got out and looked around. And that whole process of looking around it and just being in your space, it's so important. And I think, especially in the times we're in now, it's actually a really vital part of gardening, that connecting with nature. And it sounds, you know, it can sound a bit wishy-washy saying that, but from the amount of feedback I'm getting along those lines, I'm feeling really encouraged that a lot of people are doing that and getting the benefit.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And as well as that, it doesn't matter whether you're an experienced gardener or a new gardener, and we have a lot of new gardeners over the last kind of 12 months. Mm-hmm. What you really don't want to be doing is the heavy slog that isn't enjoyable, and especially if you're doing it. If you're doing it as a family. Pulling weeds, digging, doing heavy digging.
Yeah.
And to be honest, for certain people, if they take a notion and go out and start to dig a big area on a given day and don't do it in their day-to-day life, they can end up getting injured as well. So to start with something that's easy like that and that we know works, it really seems like a no-brainer, but it's a system that you kind of...
Yeah, actually, you know, like you say, no-brainer. Why no dig has been slower to catch on? You know, I thought it would catch on more quickly. It is really gaining momentum now. And I attribute some of that to social media, because for my work, for example, I can reach people, I can teach people direct through, you know, just through a powerful image. And I don't have to, in the olden days, 20 years ago, I have to get my information out through the editor of a gardening magazine or newspaper. You know, it has to be approved by people in authority. And that really slows down the process of change, because new ideas then take a long time to come out, because a lot of people feel threatened by them. You know, it's like, because it's contradicting what they've been saying themselves for a long time. You know, I'm not saying this in a blame way. It's just I quite understand how it's all come about. But it's social media is just brilliant, actually. Like yesterday, I put up this photo of it snowed here a bit yesterday, and the temperature was just around freezing, so it was only just settling. And mostly it was melting as soon as it settled. But when I looked out in my garden, I saw there was one bed in the garden that had snow on. Only one bed out of about 50. And that was the bed that I dig every year. I did a dig, no dig trial, a comparison bed side by side. One is dug, one is no dig. And the dug bed is the one that the snow was settling on. Well, it got me thinking. I put this photo on social media. There's so many comments. And just people started saying comments like, wow, this is fascinating. Well, great. I'm so happy to hear this, because it's triggered something in you. It's got you thinking, oh, what's all going on?
It's great in the conversation.
And personally, I think, you know, I'd love to know more about the explanation myself, but nobody's really looking at this. You know, scientific people say, well, there should be some scientists looking at this. Well, yeah, there should, but where's the money in it? You know, that's what it comes down to. I'm quite disillusioned with science at the moment, because it's so money led. You know, like, no, you've got to be able to pay a scientist to get a result, you know what I mean? And with no dig, there's not a lot of money in it, really, except maybe for compost.
I saw that picture that you're talking about yesterday, and I found it very interesting. And I guess I was trying to make sense of it, why that would be the case. And
yeah, but that's it, John. That you were trying to make sense of it, which means you've got your brain in gear. You're looking and thinking, and also, you know, we're thinking about things a bit more deeply like that. You know, also, I don't know if you've noticed, you go to sleep and you wake up and you have a new idea or whatever. You know, it just gets the cogs whirring and opens up possibilities. And another thing I've noticed, which is corollary to that one, is how in my dig, no dig, the water tends to sit a bit more in the dig. It doesn't seem to soak through so easily, and that I think of getting sticky mud on your boots, which we don't get here in the garden. You know, no dig, you can go out and you have clean boots. It's really nice. So yeah, I think the water doesn't drain so much. Sorry, I'll just finish. I think when soil is cultivated, dug, ploughed, whatever, it's creating a zone of impermeability where, you know how water makes a capillary layer, which is the skin you see around bottles of water when they're lying on the ground or on a bit of paper or whatever. And that is impermeable briefly. So it's both stopping water going down, so basically digging reduces drainage, not increases it. And also it's stopping warmth rising up from lower levels in the soil, like cellar temperature, it's warmer deeper down in the winter, that kind of thing. So, yeah, they're just lovely questions there to answer.
Yeah, that was actually, you've explained it much better than I was going to, but that was what my train of thought was, that the moisture was holding a bit longer in the ground in the dig system, and that's why it was that bit cooler, and the frost or the snow or whatever was lasting longer.
Well, you know, there was a gardener called F.C. King, have to be careful how I say that, in Cumbria. God, I'm trying to remember the name. Levenshall, that's it. In the 1940s, and he was experimenting with no dig then. There's a few gems in gardening history. People who've done no dig at different times and tried it out and found it good, actually. Then you think, why didn't this catch on? It was whatever reason it didn't. But I got one of his books here, which is called The Weed Problem, and it lists some of the experiments he did. And actually, one of the things he mentions is soil being warmer with his no dig. Which is a reason also, you know, when it snows, I'm looking out for those things because you've got to sort of keep an eye out, otherwise you miss them. So he helped me quite a bit. Gardening history is fascinating, you know, for some of these things that have got forgotten. There was another guy, Arthur Guest, who was a miner up in Yorkshire, Barnsley, in the late 1940s, and he had great success with no dig as well, and apparently he was on the BBC and all. And then suddenly he disappeared off the radar, and I think he might have died. You know, he was in his late 60s by then.
Yeah.
And that was the end of that. It never somehow really taken off. There's never been enough quite impetus or money behind it until now.
But we're speaking about history there, essentially, and my dad gave me, there used to be quite a thriving sugar beet business in Ireland. Where I'm situated is not far from Carlow Town, which had one of the sugar plants, and there was a sort of a grower magazine which was published by the sugar company, and it was sold actually through shops, but it was also given to the growers.
Right.
And it just had kind of nuggets of information about new, from everything from machinery to methods to whatever else, different things in it. But there was two of them that he gave me last week just to kind of look at, and they were from 1963, which is a long time ago in some ways and not that long ago in other ways. But it was really strange for me reading it, and you kind of mentioned it a little bit at the start where you said that these ideas are not new, but it doesn't make sense why they haven't continued or caught on.
Yeah.
And one of the articles that caught my eye was about compost and the organic matter levels in soil. And this was aimed at, you know, growers, but both vegetable growers, because there used to be a subsection of it called Airn Foods, and there was lots of different types of vegetables grown in the area to feed into that plant. And this article was a very, very detailed and quality article about the importance of organic matter, farmyard manure, compost, and all those things. And that almost, it was like as if at some point in time after that, that whole part of information just disappeared and it was forgotten about. And it was replaced by, as you said, you know, the chemical fertilizers and whatever else.
I think a lot of it.
Whatever the reasoning, it just doesn't make sense that that knowledge is not that the knowledge is new.
Yeah.
But that knowledge was there, and it just seemed to either be ignored or be lost in translation or whatever the case was. But it's sort of coming back now, which is great.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, all of us can bring it back as well. And I think the sharing on social media actually is really good. And I love it when people put up photos of their, you know, their lovely bed and that kind of thing. And that's encouraging other people And it just feels doable. It's not being handed down from on high as sort of lessons about what you must and mustn't do. You know, I'd love to give people the feeling that they can experiment and try things. And, you know, with no dig, going back to your original question about getting started, the big issue, I think, for many people is the weeds they might have. Also, we mentioned slugs, so if we just start with the weeds, you know, and that's where the cardboard is so useful, thick brown cardboard, not the shiny, and just put it on top of the weeds. If you put some compost on top of that, if you do that now, but what are we, 1st of February today? I don't know when you'll be listening to this, but, you know, late winter, early spring is ideal time because there's time for the weeds to die a bit, but you could make beds like this, you know, with cardboard and compost on top and planted them straight away. You don't have to wait for the weeds to die. So that's where the larger quantities of compost on top come in, because they give you a fast point of entry into growing things in a new no-dig bed. And you can do no-dig with less compost. You know, there's no hard and fast rule that you must use so much compost, blah, blah, blah. It's just about how fast you want to get in there at the beginning, for example.
Yeah, but to give someone, I suppose, exact starting points, if somebody's listening to this and is looking to get started, if, for example, they have a grass area that they want to turn into a bed, would you recommend that first they cut that grass tight and then put the cardboard down?
Yeah, I mean, it's not necessary to cut the grass tight, but the only time I would recommend it is if it's old pasture where you've got these great tussocks. I've got some of that in my new land now, and that they sort of protrude with their thick, wiry stems quite a bit above the ground. And actually, on that note, if anybody's got reeds, rushes, I would actually dig them out. You know, there's some weeds, brambles is another one, blackberries. You don't have to dig the whole ground, just dig out the main central root core, if you like, and get rid of that, or probably compost it in the long term. But then, so basically to get your ground level, that's the main thing. But there could be quite long grass there, as long as it's level, and then the cardboard on top, and then the compost on that. And that's
okay. And the cardboard, as you said, can't be shiny, you know, tie boxes. It has to be the brown cardboard with as little writing as possible on it.
Pull out any staples and get it clean, And, you know, this cardboard, I'll emphasize, it's only at the beginning stage that you need to use it. It's not every year. It's just if you've got a lot of weeds. If you were starting no dig on a, say, I don't know, dug over garden or allotment, you know, people ask, how do I start over? Rake it level and spread compost on top, maybe 5 centimeters, 2 inches, and off you go. That's it. You're into no dig, and your soil will be slowly improving all the time from then on.
And that's the sort of optimum, is it 2 to 3 inches of compost?
Well, yeah, every year here, I'm putting on now, actually 3 centimeters, 2.5 even, 1 inch. You know, that's my annual dose. That's the top-up maintenance to keep the soil organisms fed. And in my view, that's actually less than traditional gardeners use, you know, because there's no fertilizer or feeds needed with that. That's the only input I'm using in my garden. I use a bit of wood chip in the past. So about 2/3 of the area, which is the beds, get the 1 inch of compost, and then the 1/3 of the area, which is paths roughly, get preferably slightly aged wood chip, and that feeds the fungi and the past soil in it. Think of it always in terms of feeding life in the soil. And when soil is well fed, it grows fewer weeds and it grows you nicer plants. So that's the simplicity of it.
it's a very, very simple way.
That's it. That's the word to use. And I think that's why some experts turn their back a bit, because, you know, it disempowers the experts, really. You know, if it's a very simple message, which it is. It's just these little details of, you know, how you kill weeds, by space slugs. I mean, the slugs one is, that's where compost really does come in. And also, no-dig soil. You know, there's this amazing woman in America, the Soil Food Web, Professor Ingham. She has done great work on slugs in no-till and discovered that when soil is dug or ventilated, plowed, you get what she called mini layers of compaction in the soil from where the structure's been broken by the cultivation work. And then that creates anaerobic fermentation, which creates a bit of alcohol, and then that attracts the slugs. You know, it's like you created unintentionally mini slug pods all through your soil. So that was, you know, that's what she found looking at it in a microscope. And that explains to me why, you know, I've often puzzled over this one, and people complain about slugs a lot, and I'm not suffering them with no dig. Well, great, there's a scientific explanation, but the thing is to do it first. You don't have to wait for the science to sort of set you up. Often, if you think some things are going to work, have a go and see.
Yeah. What crops are successful, and is there any that are challenging in the Nordic system? Are they all successful? When you're growing your vegetable crops, is there any that are unsuccessful in that system? Or are all crops easy to grow?
Not really.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say in year one, if you're on wheat and you put down some cardboard and compost on top, you will have quite a few slugs then, because that's the temporary interim phase. When you start out with a patch of weeds, you are basically inheriting a lot of slugs, and there's no way around that. And you've got to wait for them to fizzle out with the reduction in habitat, because there's no grass growing anymore and you're just using compost. So in year one, I would not sow too many carrots or plant a load of lettuce maybe, but I found potatoes actually pretty good for that first year. Things like squash, courgettes, larger plants like broccoli. Just go out at night though, in that first summer, with a torch and knife and cut a few slugs, reduce the population. Once you've got the population down, then ongoing, it gets more easy after that.
Okay. And so, obviously, the compost is the major ingredient in no dig. It's certainly important. And I think most gardeners know what we're talking about, but just to highlight to some that don't, not talking about peat. Yeah. We're not talking about peat now. We're talking about proper compost that has been, it's made from green materials. And I know you have a huge composting system there. I've seen some pictures of it, and you have 5, 6, 7 bays.
So just before we get into that, can I say one more thing? I just remembered, actually, I forgot to mention about the slugs and raised beds. Yeah, because there's a lot of misunderstanding about beds. And from what I can see, most people assume when you talk about beds, you're talking about raised beds with wooden sides. And I just want to emphasize here that you don't have to have wooden sides. You know, that's an option, which is fine, but it's not obligatory. And it can be a snag with wooden sides to beds that as they get older and the wood starts to decompose and decay, you get pockets inside it between the decaying wood and the contents of your bed, the compost, where slugs can live by day and come out at night to feed. So if you've got old wood around beds, you've inherited an old allotment and that sort of thing, then I would remove the sides and just go side free. You save money and you'll have fewer slugs. And actually, I think you get more crops because you've got a bit of extra space at the side to grow on. But yeah, let's get on to compost.
On that there, you're using all ground beds. You're not really using raised beds at all, are you?
That's right. Mine are more like mounds, if you like. Yeah, like the waves of the sea. And I find average bed width is about 4 foot, 1.2 meters, and average path width not too wide actually, about 15 inches, so 37 centimeters, and that gives enough space. And but you know, you can vary that. There's no rule. Yeah, that's the nice thing about all these things, really. You know, the beds can be any width you want, a path can be any width you want. They can orientate pretty much any way, because that's a bit of a myth as well. That, you know, people say beds have to be north-south. Well, really, that only applies if you're growing a lot of tall crops, which are going to shade the plants on the next-door bed. But in our climate, you know, I say Ireland, anywhere in a way. You've got a lot of wind, I know that one. And you're not going to be growing loads of sweet corn and tall tomatoes and things. A lot of what you're growing is cabbage and lettuce and swedes and all that kind of thing. You know, delicious vegetables, but they're mostly low growing and they're not going to shade the neighbours. So run your beds in the way that suits you, convenient from the point of access. And also you can go up and down, which is nice if you want to, because with no dig, you haven't loosened the soil, so you're not going to get kind of erosion if it rains a lot. It's more stable. So you have to rethink a lot of these sort of advice that's traditionally handed down, because when you go no dig, a lot of it doesn't make sense anymore, and you get to sort of start again, which is great, because then you really know the reason for what you're doing.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense, though, really, when we start thinking about it. As we said already, so compost then been a major part of it. So essentially, starting out, you're talking about 2 to 3 inches essentially in year one or thereabouts. And
yeah, if you can manage that, you know, if you can get hold of more, well, even go for more. Or if you're near the sea and you put a bit of seaweed as the top layer, you know, that could work. Especially if you're making beds in autumn, seaweed's great, because a lot of it soaks in the winter, and then you just pull off the stems to put on the compost heap in the spring, that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it. Compost is the best starting point. And in terms of making your own, I think it's quite difficult when you start out to have enough if you want a decent amount. And I don't know, how, all of your listeners will be in a different situation for that, you know, where you can buy compost. But have a look around, do a search on the internet.
There's access to it all around the place. And I think that's it's important to, especially year one, if you're starting out, you're not going to have the material built up to create your own. So,
I mean, I would say, you know, for the amount of money people spend on wooden sides to their beds, for example, you know, spending on compost instead, for me, that's should be the main expense, the main ingredient. And also, you know, that if you use a larger amount in year one, you're not going to need so much ongoing. You know, it's an investment right the way through for quite a few years. So yeah, don't be afraid to spend a bit of money in this instance of starting out. But after that, you can make your own.
For sure, and build it up over time. As I said, what looks to me like a big setup you have about 7 bays, I think, of a covered.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, this is for a quarter acre market garden. And, for many people on domestic scale, the normal sort of 3 bays, each one about the width of a pallet, you know, 1.2 meters, whatever. If you're using pallets, by the way, I'd really recommend lining them with cardboard. It's a bit of a myth about air flowing in the sides of compost heaps. Put cardboard around it on the inside, and that will hold in the warmth. And it's won't make the compost any worse. It's better, actually. It'll decompose better.
That's actually one that I never get when I see people recommending pallets for airflow, because it kind of defeats the principle. The principle is that you need to build up quite a bit of heat in this mound. So letting in air at it from all sides doesn't make sense. So I've never quite understood that one, but it is recommended quite a bit.
Yeah, that's right. Well, there you go. I mean, that's the sort you don't like to question it, because everybody says it's necessary. I mean, keeping the rain off, I do find really helps as well. The nicest compost I've made is in the last 4 years since I got a roof over my heap. If you can afford that, I would say that's a really good investment, just a tin roof, steel roof. Because in our climate, rain going into a compost heap, it displaces air, basically, you know, air being so important for the aerobic process. You know, you want air in there to feed the bacteria and fungi, speed up decomposition. But the other thing I'd encourage your listeners is to get in the habit of scrounging raw materials, keep their eyes open for what's available around them. You know, even go out and cut somebody else's grasses, maybe, or whatever, you know, roadside verges. We do that here. Take the lawnmower out and cut the grass around on the roads. It's all good stuff. And bulk up the compost heap. And, you know, it becomes almost a mini hobby, making compost. I really like it because it's a whole other aspect of gardening.
There's something satisfying about it, especially when the compost turns out good. Again, it's a simple enough thing, but you really do need to follow the right mix as such. But it's not complicated, and again,
I don't get too hung up about it, I would say to your listeners, but yeah, I really would urge you actually just to watch one of my videos on that. It won't take long, and it just give you an idea. You've got the pictures as well as me explaining it. It just gives you the idea. You know, you don't have to follow it rule by rule, but I think once you've got the idea in your head of what you're doing, you'll get an eye, and you can spot what's available around you and how it might fit together into your compost heap. So a bit like making a jigsaw that is going to have the best results.
Yeah,
yeah, have some fun.
You've spoken a little bit about weeds, and in the no dig system, weeds are less plentiful, and certainly any that come, if they're ones that are just seeded onto the bed, they're quite easy to pull up as well. So it makes weeding a nicer job. And you've also mentioned that.
Absolutely, yeah. It could be quite a joyful job. I actually really like weeding because we never have too many here, but we do have some, and it needs doing. But it's not like you're going to get bogged down in a massive weed pull session. And it's a chance to just whiz through the garden, really, and spot other things as well. A bit like watering. You know, I'm a great fan of hand watering rather than watering system. Not that we need to water a huge amount, but when we are out there and you're holding a hose, or watering can or whatever, it's a treat. You spot things just being in the garden. Do you know that lovely phrase? There's no manure like the farmer's foot is one way of putting it, or another one is like the gardener's shadow. And that's just saying, basically being there. It's fertilising your garden.
Yeah, and you've mentioned as well that slugs are less of a problem. So rotation and intercropping, and particularly rotation, which is used a lot. Yeah. Is rotation followed in the same principle in no dig, or is it less necessary to rotate in the same way?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that, because it helps to illustrate a lot of different things. And I would say less necessary. And I followed, about 10 years ago, these guys, a Japanese organization called Shume. And they've got an agricultural system where they take the opposite view of Western agriculture. Instead of rotation, they do literally what they call continuous cropping, and they make a virtue of it where you plant, grow the same thing in the same place every year. Now, I'm not saying for 1 minute that I necessarily agree with that, but it's nonetheless interesting that they managed to do it successfully quite a long time. And so I having come across them, I set up a mini trial here in 2013, I'm growing the same vegetables in the same place every year. But for me, I do it as what's called a mini rotation, because I find I can get two crops here. So just to give you the one example, second early potatoes, which I put in the ground in, say, early April, and they crop by 10th of July, and that's a variety called Charlotte. So, you know, that's the beauty I like about second early potatoes. They grow so fast. 3 months from putting them in the ground, the seed, to harvesting, you've got your crop in the bag, literally. I put that in the shed. I'm still eating it now in the winter because it stores so well, you know, even though it's second early. So we're eating the potatoes, but meanwhile, the leeks are growing because I've grown in early April, transplanted. The very same day we get the potatoes out of the ground, because the quicker you do it, the more better your leek harvest will be. No wasted time. And then we're harvesting leeks, you know, through autumn and winter. So two crops a year. And I've done that now for 6 years in the same place. So potatoes, leeks, potatoes, leeks, potatoes, leeks. And why would you call that a rotation? It kind of, but if you know, if you look at it just year on year, it's potatoes, potatoes, potatoes every spring, and every summer to autumn, it's leeks, leeks, leeks. And the yields this year in year six were just as good as they were in year one and two. You know, they haven't actually varied that much. Like, I get about 40 to 48 kilos of potatoes, that's been the range, and I get 22 to 30 kilos of leeks. From this area, which is 1.2 meter wide beds and 6.5 meter long. That's been an eye opener for me. And every spring when I plant those potatoes, I think, oh, blooming heck, it's going to work. It'll be year seven this spring. And I've got a bed next to it where I'm doing broad beans, cabbage. So we've already got the broad beans are in the ground going. We pop them in December, transplants from November, saying, and they chug away, and they crop by second week of June, and I've got cabbage transplants ready, pop them in, get the cabbage harvest in the autumn. Last autumn, year six of cabbage, from the same area of ground as the leeks next door, we got 55 kilos of cabbage harvest. What is this? And I was able to make lots of lovely sauerkraut and things. And yeah, it's fascinating. You know, a bit like the snow on the soil. You know, what is easy to think? What is going on here? Why have we been told that rotation is so necessary? Where does 4 years come from? Why four? This magic number that people quote. Well, you know, if you look it up in history, it's Turnip Townsend in Norfolk with his four-year rotation that replaced the medieval three-course rotation of fallow barley and wheat, and he slotted in turnips and clover for the animals. It comes from farming, people with animals. And yeah, great, it worked really well for them, but then, hang on a minute, we're gardening, we're not farming. And, you know, gardening's always been poor relation to farming. Something that's always bugged me, actually, you know, that we get given these diktats from farmers and told how to do things. And are they actually appropriate to gardeners? And, you know, horticulture, I'm sure you must have felt this at certain times, is very much poor relation to agriculture. And hang on a minute, guys, you know, actually, horticulture involves a lot more people. And probably it's feeding a lot more people. You know, apparently, something like 80% of the world's food is grown on holdings of less than an acre or something. So let's look at this more seriously and find ways to grow plants, you know, without following the rules of farming. And certainly rotation. Yeah, I've gone on a bit, but that's a very apt one. And with no dig, because you're respecting soil health much more. So, you know, the problems are not coming in. Soil health is good. You've got more you've got more chance to grow what you want to eat. That's sort of it. You don't have to be slow.
That's really interesting. The 7 years with leeks and potatoes. That is incredible. And with no reduction.
But it's a great one. It could work in your climate, couldn't it? I mean, I know your growing season's a bit shorter than.
Oh, definitely could work here. And the idea of it's clear that in this system that what's driving this success on a 7 year cycle with leeks and potatoes is the soil health. And and soil health is something that has come up quite a bit in conversations with very good gardeners over the last 12 months.
Right.
But it's definitely something that wasn't enough of a conversation for the last good few years. That's on a gardening scale, but it's also probably on an agricultural scale.
One tip I give your listeners is if you want to succeed with these kinds of tight rotations, and particularly with the succession cropping, I know that a lot of people struggle with this one. It's actually a lot simpler, though, than you know, once you get the hang of it, the one of the important parts of it is to have transplants ready. So you're not going to be sowing seeds into soil that's been, say, vacated by your potatoes. That takes too long. If you have leek plants ready, in my case, the leek plants are already 3 months old. You know, they've been growing for 3 months. I'll pot them on even. So they're decent size. You put them in the ground, you're going to get your leek harvest much more quickly than if you, say, sowed leeks. You wouldn't really want to be sowing leeks in July, but that's a bit of an extreme example to give the idea. So getting good at propagation is going to really help you in gardening, and I'm going to give a little plug here for I do these online courses, and we separated them into modules, and one of my modules, if you like, is £30, I think, and you can get details of seed sowing and propagation. And you know, I think that is money well invested, because knowledge is power, and getting you buy the seeds. You know, if you don't look after your seeds, sow them in the right way, look after your plants, they're not going to come to as much as they could if you really have done a bit of homework and know what you're doing. There's a lot of skills in gardening that are kind of a bit forgotten. You know, I think, especially in England, maybe not so much in Ireland, but there was a whole generation that didn't really garden, you know, after the war, or even before, actually, and skills disappeared, and people having to relearn them now, and forgetting. They don't even know that what they don't know, you know, the basic skills. How you handle a rake, how you do a bit of light hoeing, using tools in the most efficient way that's not labor intensive and respects the soil.
Yeah,
you know, that kind of thing.
There's definitely, there was an information gap or a knowledge gap there, because, well, it stopped and it wasn't handed down through a generation or two, and it's needing to come back now. And for several reasons, it needs to come back. But
I mean, the skills thing, you know, and it's just how you use your body. And I think that's one of the nice things about gardening, again, well, not one of many, but using your body. You know, sometimes I feel it's like a dance thing out there. You're moving around and hopping over beds even, or whatever it might be. it just feels good. And when getting fluent using tools or handling plants and all of that, it's a nice feeling. And if any of your listeners haven't done any of this stuff, you know, don't be daunted by it, but, you know, respect what you need to learn. Don't be afraid to have a go. Beginners, you know, come on, beginners.
Yeah, get started at it. And it doesn't sound difficult, and it really, you know, listening to that, it's easy to understand, and you don't need to know an awful lot to get going at it. And you mentioned there about having your plug plants ready.
Yeah.
If you're starting out in year one, you don't have a polytunnel or a glasshouse, you may not have those that you've propagated.
Yeah, exactly. You can, or start with one bed, you know, 8 feet by 4 feet, fill it with compost. And I bet you anything, you'll be amazed at what you can grow if you've not even grown anything before. I had a lot of feedback along those lines, and people really blown away, actually, and then thrilled. And then that gives them the confidence then to do more. But yeah, if you're a beginner, don't start too big. You know, you're going to make a few mistakes. That's fine, normal and natural. But make small ones. and then if you make a mistake, don't beat yourself up about it. Just go in there and...
Yeah, figure out what went wrong and then rectify it, I guess. That's the way to think about it. Just a final question. How does no-dig work in an ornamental garden? Or have you trialed that in any big way?
That's very simple to answer. It's basically
pretty much the same, and it works well,
Possibly. I'm, I, I, you know, I've got ornamental borders here, and they're lovely, and it works really well. I mean, to encourage anyone along those lines, there's a lovely stat, actually, which is that in the UK, something like 3/4 of all flower farmers are no-dig, because they've found that how successful it is for growing their cut flowers to sell. So easy. And there's one lady, actually, called Jo... it's gone out of my head. Organic Blooms, Market Garden near Bristol. She took on a 4-acre field of stubble, hectare and a half, and cardboard compost on top, completely that, just like that, over a winter into a no-dig flower garden. Just to give you an idea. So basically, yeah, it works really well.
You've mentioned it a couple of times, and there's, in terms of where people can find you, so you've a website, you're very, very active on YouTube and your social media channels. So maybe tell people where they can find you in those.
Yeah, sure. There's loads of free information out there. That, like my YouTube channel, we've now got a hell of a library, actually. If you put in the search bar in the channel, almost anything you want to find out, from propagation to seed saving to how to pick and harvest and how to transplant and, you know, how to grow this, that and the other vegetable, it's all there in videos. And in my online courses, I've taken that a bit stage further and condensed it, well, expanded it as well, into a sort of library of information that can take you right the way through from no dig to how you grow and pick. So that's something you can actually buy if you want to go deeper into it. But just the videos is a great starting point, I say. And then on my website, there's loads of free information. And you can also buy books there if you want. I've written quite a few now. And also the annual calendar of sowing dates. That will keep you on track. Or my diary book, you know, that's a perennial diary. Just gives you that week by week guide, year on year. Once you've bought it, you've got it, and just keep referring to it. Because timing, I'll just mention that, you know, for beginners, a lot of confusing information out there. That just get a handle on what's good to sow, what's good to do each time of year, and that will massively free you up, because you won't be doing futile jobs. You know, just do what's right in the season.
Yeah, and do jobs that are worthwhile and enjoyable, and take out that heavy slog part of it.
Yeah.
Your books you mentioned. Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned your books, and I was trying to figure out, you have a lot of books. I don't know, is it 9 or 10 books? But you have quite a few. Do you want to tell people what's the most recent one, or what's the ones that you should look out for?
I mean, every year we bring out the calendar of sowing dates, and that's a nice one to hang on the wall, and then you can just look at it and see, right, what should I be sowing now day of the year, but not starting yet. The first sowing is mid-February. And then my latest book is No Dig Gardening Course, but one, it's sort of downloaded really from the actual online course, and it's a sort of A to Z of No Dig, why it works, even a bit of history of why it's been around. And how to do it, starting mulching with weeds, how to make compost. And it's got also 2 chapters in of succession plantings, small beds, plans, you know, how to take you through the year. So tons of information out, but it's something like 90,000 words. It's twice as much as most garden books. photographs. Yeah, it's really, really solid.
I've ordered 2 of them myself. So
I mean, if you want a bit of light reading, I've written a book called Myths. Yeah, because it's something that's always intrigued me. You know, why is there so much misunderstanding and misconceptions in gardening about what you have to do? And things like, we've been talking about rotation. So that's one little book that's a tenor, and just a stimulating book, I would say. You know,
very good.
So why is this the case? You can water in sunlight, all that kind of thing.
I saw, just before we finish, I saw on your website, and something that interests me, you were in Zambia at some stage, and... Did you practice no dig when you were there?
Yeah, I was. I set up a no dig garden, and it was a bit embarrassing, actually, because I got out there. I went out there on a sort of letter of recommendation from a minister who'd been in Kenneth Kaunda's government back in the 1980s, and it's still quite a long time ago. And just while I was on their plane, they had the election results, and Kaunda lost, and his rival had won, called Chiluba. So as a new president, it turned out I wasn't so welcome after all, because I had all the wrong letters.
All right.
And anyway, I managed to get to this remote village and make a garden in this school. And I was living in the headmaster's house on the school and having nice conversations with him every day. And it was all quite bizarre, really, looking back on it. Then I got a summons to go and visit the district commissioner, which was, I was on there on bike, a two-hour bike ride to get back to this place. And I thought he was going to congratulate me, instead of which he said, "Mr. Darding, I'm not impressed. You have been smuggling emeralds." and they kicked me out of the country, basically, to cut a long story short.
Well, that was the end of my... I should tell you the reason I asked. I had a granduncle who actually was out there for a number of years. He was a Christian brother, and he was out there teaching. And I know he told me at times that they were trying to grow things. And that's why when I saw Zambia on the site, it caught my eye, and
that taught me more than anything. I shouldn't have been there, really, I don't think. I mean, the climate is so different. Their conditions are so different. The knowledge I had and the skills, they should have been teaching me. It was a valuable lesson to me, actually. Yeah. I don't regret going, but good luck to them. I mean, it's a different experience, very much in Equatorial Africa.
Charles, it has been a brilliant chat, and definitely, no dig, it has enlightened me a little bit. Since I was asked this question, I have been researching it, and it definitely seems like the way forward for anybody, really. And definitely, I hope the message spreads further, and that the principles and all that get used more, because as we said earlier, it's not new information, but it's just information that seemed to either disappear or go dead for a while, and it needs to be revived and talked about and spread. Thank you very much for doing that. You've done a brilliant job explaining it.
Chatting with you, John, it's been fun, and it's just the kind of spirit of gardening that I like to encourage. Enjoy it.
Charles, thank you very, very, very much for coming on Mastering My Garden podcast.
Okay, bye bye.
So that's been this week's episode. A huge thanks to Charles for coming on. He's a real expert in this field, and I suppose it's lovely to see somebody who is practicing what they preach day in, day out. And if you look up his YouTube and all of his social channels, there's information pretty much every day, new information every day on it. And then there's very interesting things like what he said about the beds, where the only bed with snow left on it was the one that was a dig bed that was part of an experiment. So that was really interesting. And the principles are solid, the ideas are solid, and the success is real. So for somebody looking to start, or somebody already doing it and finding the slog of dig gardening too much, it's definitely well worth moving over to it. So that's been this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. And until the next time, happy gardening.